Welcome, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here, on one of my favorite stations, KSER.
And we don't know you, sir. You just walked in. And we... why did you want to become chair of the tribes? What was there a factor 7 years ago when you said, you know, I think not only can I do this job, but I need to do this job?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, you know, what propelled that decision other than an opportunity to serve our people in another way, and not only serving our people, but serving the greater community, because as folks might know, we have our reservation, and we have a economic development called Quilceta Village, but we also were part of a larger community. So representing the tribe at all levels was very important, and, you know, I want to take this time to also say that Stan Jones, our chairman of 24 years and a board member for 44 years, did an outstanding job, and he was quite a mentor to me, and so I thought maybe it was time to step up to the plate.
Was there something that you felt the tribe was doing that it shouldn't be doing, or maybe there was something that you should be doing that it wasn't happening, and you felt that you could direct the tribe in that direction?
I think we were headed in the right direction, absolutely, with Stan's leadership and other Tulalip Board of Directors' leadership, you know. What I was really hoping to see, and we were on that path, but I wanted to push it a little harder, was for our people, the services, social services, other things that helps give our people a better quality of life. You know, it's been a tough journey for many of them, but maybe moving a little bit more emphasis in that direction. But also remembering that it's a balance, too. You know, we have a business side and a services side, and making that balance. But I really wanted to hopefully move us in a direction towards our people.
Well, of course, the culture of the Native Americans is very, very strong in terms of honoring the elders. Mm-hmm. And here you were challenging Stan, who'd been with the tribes, with the tribal council for many, many years. He was a very much revered elder. Did you pause before you decided that to do this in fear of looking as if you were not honoring your elder?
I think there was a lot of thought. You know, I thought about it, but when it came to the final analysis, I knew that he would be there, and I knew that he would. I would be being a young person compared to Stan. You know, his wisdom, how he teaches people was so important that I could benefit from that, and those that were watching would benefit too. So I think it was ended up being kind of a win-win situation in that way.
Were you viewed, though, as a young Turk coming on and challenging the establishment?
Maybe in some quarters, you know, quite possibly. But, you know, I think what I tried to do was is lead in a way that we didn't miss anything, you know, that we kept going forward. The challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis is always going to be there. But having Stan there as part of that leadership team was so important in that transition time. So, yeah.
Well, let me ask you this in terms of the way that you are the chairman of the Tulalip tribes. Why is that plural? What actually is the Tulalip tribes?
Mm-hmm. What it was is there's a number of villages in the area here, whether it be from the salt water up to the mountains and along the river systems. And in their desire to, I guess, take over the Northwest, the tribes or villages were rounded up and promised 22,000 acres, i.e. Tulalip, and we were moved there. So if we look at it, we are the successors of interest to different villages. And so at the end of the day, we have a number of people living on the Tulalip Reservation that have their heritage from different parts, if you want to say it, call it Stahob County here, Stahob. We are the Stahob people.
And the language of the Tulalips is the Lushootse.
Lushootse, yes.
And I don't think there would. This was, I think, this was the Treaty of Point Elliott in 1855
That's correct.
That created the Tulalip Reservation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there is anybody who would ever argue that the Native Americans need to protect their rights. But there are many tribes who were left out of that 1855 treaty that are trying to establish their existence. And the Tulalips have been active in fighting some of those. The Snohomish, the Duwamish, the Snoqualmie. These are peoples that have accused the Tulalips of trying to keep them out of the tribal concept and being recognized as a nation. Why not just try to bring everybody into the party?
Well, we've all long held that we are the successors of interest. In other words, of the villages that were put together on the reservation, it was composed of those that you mentioned other than the Duwamish. So, you know, those that chose to stay on Tulalip, we became, again, to use that phrase, successors of interest. So we've always held that position. And
there are those that say that the cultures of the tribes were such that they clashed and that they really couldn't live together on the reservation because there were historical and cultural differences that forced them not to, yet they're being denied their recognition as tribes.
Yes, and certainly that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is we were always working with each other in an effort to survive and to grow in the Northwest, trading with each other, maybe finding a spouse or a significant other in another village. Sharing of resources and stuff asked us to work together. So, you know, that's the other side of that coin as well.
And is this still an ongoing conversation among some of these, the Snoqualmie, I believe, are Whidbey Island tribe? Mm-hmm. So are there still discussions and conversations going on, or is the discussion as far as the Tulalips at an end?
Well, that's always, you know, always going to be our position, that we are the successors of interest. You know, you've got a number of villages or people, descendants of villages, such as the Kikialis up north a little bit farther, that are maintaining that position. But, at the end of the day, you know, there was an opportunity for them to locate at Tulalip. But for whatever reason, they chose not to. And for those that did, we became Tulalip tribes and the successors of interest.
And their argument that the Tulalips are doing this for financial interests and that they want to keep these peoples from setting up competing casinos and rake some of the profits from gambling away from the Tulalips?
Mm-hmm. I've heard that, and certainly I don't put a whole lot of faith in that. I think it goes right back to what happened in 1855 and the succeeding years, that opportunity to locate to where Tulalip or other reservations, because that it's not only an issue here at Tulalip, but at other reservations as well, that they're having to weigh through that and make their decision whether to support a recognition of a new tribe or an existing tribe, if that be the case, or a band of people that had that opportunity to locate on the reservation but chose not to.
We're talking with Mel Shelton, chair of the Tulalip tribe. Let's dispatch one other controversy, and that's the Marysville School District. Michael Kundu, a Marysville school board member, made some statements in an email challenging the intellectual capacity of some minority groups, set up a firestorm. Mm-hmm. You, along with the NAACP, Janice Green, mm-hmm. are asking him to resign. He has since repudiated the research and the doctor from which he drew the statements that he made in his email. Are you only going to be satisfied if he does resign rather than repudiating what he said?
Well, once a bell's rung, it's hard to unring it. And the statements that Mr. Kundu made, or email statements, were just, they were horrible. My community came to me and told me stories of the hurt they received in school, whether it be through teachers or principals or administrative people. There was a lot of stories that came forward, and it was like being re-traumatized. So, to answer your question, nothing short of resignation people do. He can apologize all he wants, but once that bell was rung and the traumatization that happened, and not only Tulalip people, but other people came forward with stories of hurt, of what happened to him in school. And, you know, if he can resign and allow us to heal and move on, I think, too, out of it will come a better relationship with the Marysville School Board. We understand going through something as horrible as this together, it asks us, it demands us to work better together for our children, for all children in our community.
Well, I wonder also if it might not be turned to a positive in that I think everyone is aware of and very concerned about the horrible rate of dropouts for Native American students in high school. I think less than 50% of high school students actually graduate. Native American students actually graduate. So if it is not the individual's DNA, then it must be culture.
Well, there's a number of things that go into making a child successful in graduating. And, you know, whether culture is very important, especially we've noticed with our kids, if we can put into the curriculum something about our culture that helps them learn. And we have to take this time to thank Representative John McCoy for legislation that asked for history and culture to be included in curriculums, a real big step in the right direction for our kids, you know, because knowing who you are via your culture, Lushoot Seed, or other such activities, I believe empowers our kids, and it empowers them in a good way. And then if you throw in the equation, the parents stepping up to the plate, being part of the kids growing up, you know, and they are, our parents are, but maybe to another level, whether it be enjoying culture together with them or learning Lushoot Seed together. We have Culture Night out at the tribe. You know, those are good things, beneficial things that helps make it happen.
Of course, now the Native American culture is very, very much oral related. It is very much relying on the oral process of learning, as opposed to, let's call it, the white culture educational system, which is book learning and things of that nature. So does that become a factor? Are you trying to get the Marysville schools to become a little bit more cultural sensitive in that way? Or are you finding greater success in setting up your own schools on the reservation?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion, both within our community, with the board of directors and our staff, about what could the possibilities be of having our own school. You know, and I applaud that conversation. There's some realities. It costs money to build a school and run a school. But it also gives us an opportunity to help have a bigger say. Now, we're working with Marysville School District and funding different projects that benefit not only Tulalip kids, but all kids. And, you know, I think that's a positive relationship. But at the end of the day, you know, it's coming together and listening to the kids. How do they want to learn? What's their best way of learning? You know, by rote or however it is, you know, there's a lot of, debate that goes on. You know, certainly hands-on learning is great. You know, when I was got out of high school, I essentially took BOTEC training. I went into the Army and they taught me how to fly a helicopter, and it'd be like trying to drive an 18-wheeler, you know, BOTEC. Then I went and got a BA from the University of Washington. So I got to see a VOTEC side as well as a learning, you know, reading the books, reading and writing side, you know, and every student's different. So trying to match up their learning ability with how to teach them a methodology is so important.
Did the VOTEC and the military give you the skills necessary to do the BA? Could you have gone from high school into the University of Washington, or did you need that interim of VOTEC and the Army to be able to develop the skills necessary to comprehend college?
Well, I think it was for me, as one person, it was the right decision. I didn't think that the war was going to keep going on, but it did. And so those life experiences helped me become more confident of who I was, confident in my decisions. The training I received, attention to detail, was very important as I later went on to college, you know, learning to read and write. That was part of the training that we we received, even though it was learning to fly a helicopter, learning to be an officer, and learning to those skills was also part of the training I received.
Before we turn to the future of the tribes, I just want to get a little bit more background about you. Growing up, did you grow up in a family, in a culture that honored your heritage? I'm sure you grew up watching many of the same TV and movies that I did, John Wayne, Lone Ranger. Did you draw a connection from what you were seeing on television about Indians and Native Americans and yourself? Was that part of your heritage and your culture?
Well, certainly, you know, Hollywood did its best to try to give me an idea of what a Native American was all about, and certainly if I remember some of the country western movies, it was more Sioux Indians more than anybody.
The Plains Indians.
The Plains Indians.
Were the bad people.
But in reality, it was my mother and my grandmother that shared with me my heritage, being Native American. Now, just want to share with you that mom and dad divorced when I, just before I entered kindergarten. And so next thing I know, we've moved from the reservation. And I didn't see my dad till I was 18 years old. But it was through those years, Mom always made us remember that we were Tulalip. We were Tulalip, and also we were Sisseton Wahpeton, which is Sioux. And to be proud to remember that, we were very special kids. And I think that any parent always does that with their kids, to make them feel special, but also remember who they are. And so, yes, I watched TV and saw that rendition, but Mom and Grandma really made the impression for us of who we were.
And then did you experience the discrimination growing up because you were Native American? Were there times that you were put down in school or put down by town people because you were a Native American?
Well, some of the stories I've heard, at home on the reservation, there was some pretty open racism towards our tribal members. For me, it was when I went to school, we were a minority of minorities, and it was a very subtle racism. You really, it wasn't blatant in my face. Otherwise, I would have had to come out fighting. But it was kind of a low-level racism. You always knew it was there, but you couldn't fight it. You know, that's just the way it was. And I think experiences later in life, once they figured out I was Native American, I had to work twice as hard.
And did that include learning to become a helicopter pilot? Did you have to fight to get into helicopter pilot school and to rise to the level of an officer?
Well, I think certainly I qualified. I took all the tests to enter flight school, and in actuality, I had my TAC officers were very supportive. There wasn't very many minorities that went to flight school, if the truth be known. I look back at our class pictures, and there's a few of my Afro-Americans, a few Latinos, not very many Indian people going to pilot training. But while I was in Nam, I had several crew members that were Native Americans. So, yeah, it seemed like there was a wall there, but I received some pretty good support to make it through.
And what do you think, as a result of being a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, serves you best now? The training to make split-decision decisions or the ability to delegate authority?
A little bit of both. Obviously, in being chair or working with the Tulalip Board of Directors. And I want to take this time to commend the Tulalip Board of Directors, starting with Chuck James, Marie Zach Hughes, Glenn Gobin, Marlon Freiberg Jr., Don Hatch, and Mark Hatch. They're a great team that Tulalip has there. And so, yeah, it's easy to delegate to this group, because we have this common goal of working for our people and wanting the best. Delegating and making decisions, it all helped out. But when you have a good team working with you, those things you learned are easier to do later in life.
How does the board manifest itself? What is it? Is it made up of representatives from the individual tribes that make up the Tulalip tribes, or are they elected at large? How does it come to be?
Right. Any member 18 years and older can get a petition, get five signatures, and run for a board of director position. And that's a 3-year term. So on General Council Day, we come together, and there's how we do it is some years there's one year there's three positions open, then the two succeeding years it's two positions. So, you know, staggered terms, and whoever the highest vote getters are elected to the seats.
And who can vote? The people living on the reservation or the tribal members?
All tribal members 18 years and older. So they can also send in their mail-in votes for that particular day, who they support as a candidate. And then when it comes to chairman, vice chair, secretary, and treasurer, it's the people present who vote on that day who they want to be their chairman, vice, and secretary, and treasurer. And I think, you know, going back, that's what makes Stan so awesome. For 24 years, the people gave him the vote of confidence.
And who gets to claim membership in the tribe? How much of Native American do you have to have in your heritage to be able to have the right to vote?
At Tulalip, we have what is called a residency requirement, and that's living on the year on the reservation for a continuous year. Either your parent has done that, and therefore you qualify. Now, I've lived on the reservation for a year, so my children would be able to be enrolled. Now, but let's say, for an example, they got enrolled, but they chose to live off the reservation for whatever reason, job or whatever, but they didn't spend any time living on the reservation establishing that, then their children would not be eligible to be enrolled. So, it, you know, it's living on the reservation that brings that to a residency requirement.
Again, back to the way the politics works. Then you, as the chair, are voted to the position of chair by the members of the council.
By the members of the general council.
The general council.
Those that attend on the day of voting. And on that day, too, we discuss items of interest. If the people want transparency, they want to talk about a budget, or if it's a program, or if we're not doing something right, they give us guidance, they give us direction. So it's a great day. It's what I'm so proud of our people, because we have anywhere from 300 to 700 people show up, and up to 900 people that vote on that day. So Tulalip people care about their community, and they do it by showing up to vote and showing up to general council.
And there's no differentiation with regard to the individual tribal heritage of the people. It's sort of an at-large election then.
Right, yeah. While some of us may be able to trace our roots back to being Stahoe people, or maybe some of it is upriver people, we're still, at the end of the day, Tulalip people.
I want to, just before we move into the future of the tribes, talk a little bit more about you and your growing up. Because what years were you in Vietnam?
I got over to Vietnam late 70 and then into 71.
So. Okay. So you were 18, 19 years old?
19 years old when I got over there.
Voluntarily, or were you drafted?
Yeah, I volunteered. Right. I finished high school, or when I was getting into my senior year, and I didn't feel I was quite ready for college. I just had 12 years of schooling, so I wanted to do something a little different. And, you know, there was a lot of men and women killed in Vietnam by 1969, and there was a real tug for me to want to... I just didn't know if I could go the rest of my life without showing some kind of appreciation, and one way for that, for me, was to join and, at the end of the day, end up serving over there to respect those that gave their life for our country.
Well, it was also in 1969 that the American Indian Movement took over Alcatraz Island. Where was your thinking at the time when the American Indian Movement was coming to the fore? Dennis Banks was taking his leadership role. Bury My Heart in Wounded Knee was mm-hmm. just published. That book was just published. So where was your mind at the time that this radicalization of the Native American culture was coming to the fore?
I was rooting for him all the way. All the way. I had my journey I was on, you know, and if I could have, you know, years later I'd replay that period in time in my mind, and I says, if I could only could have hotwired a helicopter, went over there and helped my brothers and sisters, that would have been just great. But, you know, I supported him. And it was a very tumultuous time. If you remember, even our Afro-Americans, our black folks were, they were having a struggle too, you know, and they were in many ways leading the charge in their own way. We were all working together in our own way to further the interests, to looking for some fair treatment, more importantly, for the federal government to live up to its treaty promises to Native Americans. And if we had to do Alcatraz or Wounded Knee or take over a BIA office, that was just the way it needed to be.
Was there at times where you were thinking, here I am in Vietnam fighting for my country when my country has a 300-year history of treating Native Americans with incredible disrespect, and my brothers are fighting for their respect, and here I am wearing the uniform of my country? Were there Sunday afternoons when that sort of flitted through your mind?
I think that kind of came back. That came to me after I got home. While I was in Vietnam, my job was I was a scout pilot, so I would fly out with a Cobra. We'd go out to an area, then I'd drop out of altitude and then start looking for trails, following trails, looking for any kind of intelligence or something I could relay to the birds. So it was somewhat of a dangerous job. We lost a few of my brothers that got shot down, got killed. A lot of aircraft got shot up. So during that period of time, I was thinking more of survival, doing my mission, doing it right, and getting home. But you're right. When I got home later, I got to thinking about it, you know, the ironicness of it all.
And were there times when you thought, well, maybe you should put on the radical shirt and you should become a little bit more politically active in fighting for and demanding the rights that you are entitled to under treaties?
Absolutely. You know, that definitely crossed my mind. I wanted to go out there, whether it be in the Midwest or you know, if I could have went down to Alcatraz. But the route I chose to do was to educate myself on federal Indian law, the history, our history, to know it and understand it to a much better depth. And then even though I became a fisherman for a number of years, commercial fisherman, finding a way to continue fighting the battle for our people, with our people and for our people.
I suspect that you've heard something similar to what I'm going to say here in many different ways and in many different words, and I'm just curious to know how you respond when someone says, look, the conditions of the country 200 years ago, the conditions of society, it's a different world than it was 150 years ago, 200 years ago when these treaties are signed. It's unfair to expect to be held to these pieces of paper that were signed and promises made 200 years ago.
Absolutely. You know, an example of that is when the Judge Bolt decision came down, and there was so much acrimony towards Native American people for something that was a treaty right. And I think there was some suggestions that we go back and use nettle nets, you know, use the old way of making the nets. If you want to catch fish, go do it the old way, just like they did 150 years ago.
I think that was something similar was said when the Indians out on the peninsula got the right to go and hunt whales. They said, well, you need to use the traditional methods of hunting whales, not contemporary weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you respond to that? This is 2010. We're in the 21st century. This was 17th century agreements that we made. It's not fair to hold the country to those agreements.
Well, but it's a treaty right, and the government failed to live up to its treaty rights, so we need to hold the federal government up to its treaty rights, regardless of the other examples that a person can give. You know, our people suffered for years. You know, Stan in his book, and I'm going to put a little pump in for Stan Jones's book. He wrote a biography, and he talks about flour with worms in it. You know, I mean, that was what they got. Now, we can never go back and rectify that. That is in history. That is part of his memories. But we have to fight today so that things like that don't happen.
And it's we like to sit here and say that it is not going to happen, and it would be better if you would just abrogate the treaties and become assimilated into society.
The biggest simulation wheel just keeps on turning. I know. I've watched it. I've studied it. And I'm so proud of Tulalip and a lot of Indian people because it's our culture. It's our language. Those things, called that spiritual nourishment that we need that so we can get up and fight that assimilation battle because it's going on, you know. We are very proud of who we are, and we can never forget who we are. And those things that make us who we are, we can never let go. For an example, the shoot seed was almost gone, almost went into the history books as some forgotten language. But we had some elders who remembered it, and they held on to it furiously against even their training. Many of our elders have the memories of being told they couldn't speak their language. And hopefully, you know, the assimilation wheel would say it'll be forgotten and the only thing you'll speak is English. Well, they held on to it and they revived it. And today as we speak, we have children, our children, learning how to speak Lushoot seed. And I've been in a classroom and I've seen 25 young kids, third graders, speaking Lushoot seed. And it makes you so proud it just chokes you up seeing that. Our culture being sustained again, where it was almost wiped out.
And I think Vi Hilbert was one of the leading advocates of keeping that language alive. And when I think her passing about 5 years ago, I think, was a great loss.
A great loss, but the monumental work that she did continues to live on, and that's what we're so proud of.
We're talking on Sound Living this afternoon with the chairman of the Tulalip Tribe, Mel Shelton. What keeps you up nights now? Worrying. What's at the top of your worry list as chair of the Tulalip Tribes?
Mm-hmm. I think, how can we help our people better? You know, what is it through programs? Is it, you know, and for an example...
Well, you've got all the money in the world from your casinos.
Well, one would think that, but, you know, we tax ourselves 100%. I don't like using that tax word, but, you know, profits that we make goes right back into our people somehow, some way, in programs, for education. If we have somebody who graduates from high school and they want to continue their education, whether it be a liberal arts or a hard science or even a vo-tech, the tribe funds it. We may not be able to cover 100%, but for most of our students' needs, we are funding 100% of their educational needs. So those things that were dreams are now reality. Can we continue that? Because we have a larger growing tribal population. We have the elders, the baby boomers, myself, are starting to look at the golden years and the type of programs we have for our elders, whether it be medical, whether it be building a new home for a needy elder, different programs there, that cost money. Another thing we have is for our young kids, you know, education, health, and other such things, family services, if there's anything going on that counseling is needed. We use a little bit of government grants and a lot of tribal hard dollars. So, yeah, what seems like a lot of money, we reinvest into our community.
I think you put... A huge amount of money into a stop smoking campaign. Was it $500,000 that you put in?
Yeah, we were very, it was part of our agreement with the state that smoking cessation, and we're helping run that program. And, you know, I advocate anybody that's smoking, if you can, quit smoking. I smoked for 30 years, and so I've quit now, but it was through the help of a cessation program that helped me get me there, so that's a good thing.
And I would say that the Tulalips have been very generous. You give away lots of money to the Boys and Girls Clubs. KSER has benefited in the past from some grants from the Tulalips, so you're not just putting that money in under your mattress somewhere on the reservation and sleeping on it. You are pushing it around and sharing it around.
Yeah, and Ed, I really appreciate that observation. Yeah, we do, and you know, we're so privileged and honored to be part of a larger community, and the type of funding that we can do to help those that need a little bit of help. We're there to help out. You know, we remember our friends, and we want to stand with them when they need the help.